The Andrew Carrington Hitchcock Show with your host, Andrew Carrington Hitchcock.
Hello, everybody. And back today, by popular demand, is Ray West. And he's going to talk us through some, well, you know, with Ray's shows, he takes us on a journey through all sorts of different research that he's done, which is why he's so popular on this show. But I'm going to bring him up right now. Ray, are you with me?
I'm here. Yep, live and kicking.
Excellent. Well, great to have you on board again. Now, we were discussing, you know, what to call this show, and I know that you want to talk about various forms of propaganda worldwide. So let me just hand over to you and you start off, because I know you've been doing a lot of preparation to do this show. So take it away.
Yeah, thanks. Good. Well, I want to discuss propaganda and education and how they intertwine, in particular with official worldviews, because, of course, you get a worldview promoted usually top down. And it's all intertwined with education and propaganda. I want to start here with philosophy, really. I choose to start here with Bertrand Russell, who's not as well known as he was. I'll use his History of Western Philosophy, which was published in 1945, to start off with. Now, Russell had a very standard Victorian format for the history of the world. You start with Greece and Rome. You have a few nods to Babylon, Persia, Egypt, and so on. Then you have Christianity in the Middle Ages, and then you get to modern times with partly digested science and partly understood, quotes, democracy, unquotes, with a lot of omitted stuff, notably finance and a rather naive victor's view of wars. Now, and Russell also regarded the 13th century Roman Catholic synthesis as being as complete as it was possible to be, although he soft pedals violence of conversion, the truths about money and putting down of heresies. Now, his History of Western Philosophy was a popular book in its time. There must be lots of copies around. It's a good book in a certain sense. It gives you a good overview, even though it has errors. I remember that Harold Hillman, the biologist, once said to me that a book by Stephen Rose on cell biology was a very good book. I knew what he thought of Rose, and I was a bit puzzled. What he said was that if you want to know the current mistakes, it was a good summary. And in this sense, Russell's History is a good book. Now, his format is very typical of learned books in the 19th century. I have here a copy by J.M. Robertson, A Short History of Morality. There's another book by Joseph McCabe, History of Women. There are sundry writers like Green, the historian, Winwood Reed, Andrew Dixon's War of Science with Theology. These all have the format of the ancient world, the medieval world, and then Europe. And this applied up to about 1917, where even academics began to notice new things. And they typically describe them as revolutions rather than coups, following the mold of the French Revolution. And to his death, Russell always referred to the Jewish USSR as Russia. And it's extraordinary how robust this model was. I mean, even after 1945, Hugh Trevor Roper, a Regius Professor of History, thought that Caesar and his wars in Latin was an ideal training ground for British public schoolboys in the 19th century. He just had no idea of such things as finance. Now, Russell once wrote this on J.S. Mill, that a subject and a predicate together make a proposition, and he said that was a 2,000-year-old error. It's a typical Russell word-based worry. He failed to notice the possibilities of lies, obstructions, and persuasions on collecting evidence. And I mean, it can be argued very convincingly that philosophy as an official subject deals with any subject provided it's verbose and that it's unimportant in practice. And if we look at Russell, as with many rationalists, he hoped that future generations would not believe in faith, but they would substitute loyalty for evidence. Russell thought it was easy enough to discover what was happening in the world. All you have to do is read a newspaper with the opposite views to the one you've already got. He simply had no idea that good ideas can be submerged by a flood of output, which is shown by his book on German social democracy, the first book he wrote. Anyway, what I want to mention is teleology. It's well known in evolutionary circles as a mistake to avoid. Russell says correctly that cause can be used in a mechanical sense, but also in a human affairs sense. You know, why does a baker make bread? Because people will be hungry, is one of his examples. And Russell says, this is quite a key point, I don't see how it could have been known in advance which of these questions science ought to ask. but experience has shown that the mechanistic question leads to scientific knowledge. Now, Russell only notices two alternatives there. He hasn't noticed the third possibility, which, of course, is a characteristic of Jews, that evidence could be destroyed, lies, bribery, and violence can be introduced and so on. And, of course, this is a parasitic attitude on general knowledge, and it has been for a couple of thousand years. So that's 2,000 years of important error, is omission of the deliberately destructive influence of Jews. Let's kind of try to update that a bit with infusion of modern reality. And many people have probably noticed the Jew-inspired promotion of hatred against whites. I mean, at the moment, there's particularly blacks in the US. There are plenty of examples. There's deliberate suppression of black violence, such as rapes. And there is these ridiculous Jewish campaigns of the Trayvon Martin type and the Black Lives Matter type. And all this goes back at least to Lyndon Johnson in the 1960s. If you've noticed this, you're in a position to understand, for example, how Germans and Russians must have felt the same sort of manufactured hatred from British and US soldiers. So that's what it feels like to have blacks sort of behaving in insulting manners at the moment. This is, it could get, well, it's likely to get worse. Now, I want to see how this intersects with propaganda. Now, here's Hilaire Belloc in his book The Jews. This was 1920, and he's discussing the 19th century, the 1800s, and he's talking about the rise to monopoly of Jewish international news agents, Reuters being, of course, a well-known one, and the presence of Jews as correspondents. And he gives examples here, a Bohemian Jew called Opper, who used a false name of Dublowitz. He was the Paris correspondent for the Times. And in this way, Jews who have international networking produced a slow drip of anti-German, anti-Russian, anti-American, anti-British stuff, as they thought required. And I think probably this was an occasional thing. It's kind of artistic. You have not to overdo it. You'd get phrases like the Germans showing their typical unreasonableness, the Russian Tsar being autocratic and intransigent, as usual. And you can imagine the complacent Britons reading their Times, imbibing anti-German feeling with their mother's milk, is how it was described. And with a little bit more imagination, you can imagine Germans being fed material on the British cunning and deceit and so on, and French readers on perfidious Albion. I'm not very familiar with Russian in the proper sense, Russia, not the USSR, their propaganda, but that must probably have been influenced in the same sort of way as well. And of course, the more isolated countries are, the more this works. And the USA is a perfect example of a country which has been very largely colonized by Jewish propaganda and militarism. Although, to its credit, Americans are not completely gullible. They have gone some way to counter it, although it's only very weakly so far. And in fact, I noticed the other day that the tireless Miles Mathis has come to believe that most, or possibly all, US presidents were Jewish, and therefore the USA probably was set up right from the start as a Bank of England Jewish state, complete with their kind of flattering blather about being, you know, pioneers and the greatest generation, all this kind of stuff.
I saw a website, Ray, where it said that they managed to link them all to one particular king. Have you seen that?
Is that a Mathis piece?
I think so. I may be wrong.
There are some in... He had various dynasties, for example, the Jagiellons, whether you pronounce it, in Poland. He's certainly done some good stuff. I wouldn't say there's one. I wouldn't have thought there could be, because you get kings sort of dotted about in Europe. And I think the same thing must have applied when they were being set up. But there certainly is a good case to be made for the whole idea of class and this sort of sociological bullshit to be replaced by just simple blood ties.
This is a Daily Mail piece. I just looked it up. It says, is ruling in the genes? All presidents bar one are directly descended from a medieval English king. And
He might. When they say English king, they probably mean a Jew. I mean, William the Conqueror, according to Mathis, was a Jew. Anyway, if that's true about the US presence, it might explain why the USA is quite different from Europe. There's a money priority all the time. There's not much genuine history, not much community feeling. It's sort of not much mother love. There's not much kind of family affection. And all this is possibly, at any rate, a because of Jews behind the scenes running things. And of course, they can't admit that they've been lying since 1776 and before. Now, anyway, let's go on here about more about propaganda. Well, Russell wrote in 1945 a piece called The Bomb and Civilization. This was in response to what I'd regard as the propaganda of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And he must have been fed the information. It was a fake thing. There's some science in there which he must have just been quoting. So he was used as a useful idiot. He never had any doubts about that. There's a Jew in Canada called Cyrus Eaton who hosted the Pugwash meetings, they were called, which was allegedly about disarmament, although presumably Eaton was using them to keep an eye on them to make sure they didn't find too much. Let me just mention a few names here. If you look at my website, I've got a search engine, and there's an enormous number of Jews in this nuclear thing. Hermann Kahn was one of them. He was a Jew from Hungary. Edward Teller was supposed to have invented various bombs and things. There's, of course, people like Kissinger and the RAND organization. Robert Jungk was a writer on the supposed history of the atom bomb. There's somebody called Ulam, U-L-A-M. Of course, there was Einstein putting his oar in. There's Oppenheimer, a Cohen who supposedly invented the neutron bomb. There's Edward Bernays, the propagandist. I think he was a nephew of Freud. There are all these alleged spies, Rosenbergs, Morton, Sobel. Harry Gold was one, David Greenglass. And of course, there was Bernard Baruch, who kind of ran a lot of this stuff. I'm just quoting his names because there's endless ones of them. And I do recommend people could look at my website. And it's actually got two search engines. One is for nukes, one is for the other stuff. But there's an awful lot of stuff there. And please, please make a bit of effort and look this stuff up. Anyway, Russell was got involved in this. And he must, in my view, was just a useful idiot. And he kept the thing bubbling on this fake with nuclear weapons between the USSR and the USA. Anyway, about 20 years after that, he wrote a book called War Crimes in Vietnam, which is what makes me think that Russell's basically honest and not a crypto-Jew. Incidentally, the War Crimes in Vietnam, it's 1967, it was published, a set of essays. It's one of the few of his books not reprinted by the literary assigns of him. His image is as a sort of philosopher above mere politics. They kind of try, they geld him, you know. Anyway, War Crimes in Vietnam had an exchange of letters with the New York Times, which, as far as I know, was owned then as now by Jews, the Salzburgers and Oaks, that kind of thing.
Ray, I've just got a quick question, because this is something that you talk about a lot, the fake nuclear weapons, and of course they're talking at the moment, nuclear war, North Korea, America, UK, all that sort of stuff. Is there a way that you can give your reasons for saying that nuclear weapons don't exist? Because, of course, people will say, well, look at Hiroshima and things like that, look at these tests.
Yeah. It's difficult because it's such a complicated issue.
I know, that's the thing. We can always do a separate show on that, but if there's any way that you
can... I would recommend people, to save time here, to look at Nuclize, that's one word, NUKELIES.org, and that's a forum which was frozen, in fact, in about 2012, and it had a number of very good contributors. I'd say there were about six or eight leading contributors, and there's a section on Hiroshima, which demolishes it. It was bombed by air. It was like any other airstrike. And they must have made up the story. Of course, there are inconsistencies when you're inventing a big lie. They got the radiation wrong, and they got the name of they got the pilots wrong, all this kind of stuff. But take it from me and these other people that Hiroshima and Nagasaki were faked. If you look at DVDs of nuclear stuff, which you can now get, they were freed up in the 1990s, so you can actually get them and watch them frame by frame and see the various evidences of fakery. I've got some YouTubes on the subject, sort of miscellaneous ones on how the thing was made up the use of models in their films. And in fact, it seems to be worldwide. If you look at alleged Chinese nuclear tests in Pakistan, nuclear tests and French ones. They show interesting local variations. The French ones are very sort of artistic, as if done by painters. And the Chinese ones are a bit kind of shriek and shrill, and the Pakistani ones are kind of third world and amateurish. They have what's obviously underground explosives, making not very impressive, explosions. It's up to you to look for yourself, really, but I promise you that the whole thing is fake, and this business with Korea is, I mean, it's ridiculous, isn't it? Korea's the size of, like, half a US state or something.
Yeah, and one thing as well is just, sorry to jump in, Ray, it's just... Chernobyl, for example, people just can't live there. You know, that's a massive exclusion zone around it since the accident. So how come people are able to live in Hiroshima and Nagasaki so soon after?
The Chernobyl thing is... Oh, the nuclear power...
Yeah, do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, that's what they say. It's just not true. It's perfectly livable. There are people living there, wild animals living there.
Yeah.
It's just... I promise you, it's, for want of a better word, bullshit. But the nuclear power issue is somewhat different from the bomb thing, because it's presumably impossible, at least in principle, they might get heat out of it. But I was converted to both these things by Desjardins in Canada, but unfortunately doesn't talk to anybody about it. But he got most of these ideas originally. He was an electric power worker, I think, or something. I think he had something to do with designing electricity. But anyway, it's a different issue, although, of course, it's obviously connected with propaganda and also education, because anyone doing physics kind of will get this sort of stuff thrown at them, although it's not an important issue. I was speaking to an Australian about salt the other day, and he majored in nuclear physics, and he said there are no jobs in it. That's not quite true. There are jobs in it for Jews, because the Jews kind of corral anybody. So I think it's another worldwide Jew thing, which is run, and they make money out of it. So you can't, in a way, you can't blame these people for collecting vast income. If you're a Pakistani or something, you get a lot of money. They may not even know it's a fake. It might be the most likely thing is that there'll be Jews running the supposed technical stuff. However, let me just get back to Vietnam. Now, Russell never understood the difference between Americans themselves and sort of scum like Kissinger and Lyndon Johnson, who were both Jews or crypto-Jews. And that's a very important issue, because a lot of people might like to consider whether they really want to side with killers and butchers. And there's if you look at on my website, I've got a book which I put up, because I thought nobody else would, probably correctly. And they had... I've got a little quotation here. It's been fought from the air with napalm and fragmentation bombs, helicopter gunships and pellet bombs, the spraying of poisons on acres of crops, and the use of enormous high explosive weapons. That's true. I mean, they were testing things which might have been equivalent to nuclear weapons, and they had free fire zones and so on. They'd kill prisoners. They'd get into Vietnamese villages and rape the women, that kind of thing. These are little kids, you know. They'd be. If you want to side with people like Kissinger, you're supporting rape of pubescent girls. That's the fact of the matter. And incidentally, Vietnam was part of the French Empire, or what was called the French Empire. It has a tiny proportion of Roman Catholics inserted into it, and in my view, this has a damaging effect. For example, Hoffman, who's done a lot of work on Judaics, he can't free himself from this Roman Catholic thing, and that kind of ruins his work, in my view. Anyway, I'm still talking about Russell here and his puzzlement over propaganda. I do recommend that people look at my forum online and decide for themselves how much it was a fraud. I think the nuclear issue may be the biggest fraud of all. Although, of course, accurate figures are not likely to be available. And probably, in fact, it's also second to the entire Jewish banking fraud, which, of course, is virtually worldwide. It doesn't include North Korea, apparently, but it's virtually...
I said I heard that. That was something. That's the real reason they're after North Korea, because the worldwide banking empire doesn't include that. And I'd just like to point out to the listeners, your website, big-lies.org. So that's big-lies.org if you want to look it up while you're listening to this show. Go ahead, Ray.
Okay, thanks. I've got here in front of me, I've got a little collection of books. I'm a bibliophile. I collect all these things. I've got a December 1969 National Geographic the one with the famous cover photo of a fake astronaut. It's also got a little 33 RPM record. It's not a CD in it. And it's got about 60 pages of fake photos. It's absolutely astonishing, the amount of work. You know, if you're Jews, the amount of work they're willing to put in for their frauds is just astonishing. As is illustrated, of course, by what perhaps is the third largest fraud, the Hollow Hoax. And we should include in that, of course, censorship by Jews of mass deaths in the Soviet Union, Ukraine, and places in the Eastern Europe, like Latvia and so on. And, of course, the Germans after the Second World War was partially publicized recently by James Back. I think you've interviewed him, haven't you?
Yeah,
Bach,
recently.
B-A-C-Q, yes.
Yeah.
Anyway, what comes from this, at least in my view, is that the Jewish policy isn't to maximize money or assets, but to maximize deaths of opponents. The object really is not a profit maximizing, but death maximizing. And since about 1920, with the Kudenhove-Kalergi plan, I've got that on my website, they've targeted whites, and I presume it's instinctive to them. They have homicidal impulses against whites. They occasionally show up. I remember, I'll go on to that anyway, Kevin McDonald talking about it. So we have this new interpretation of Hitler and Stalin, for that matter, that between them as possible Jews, crypto-Jews, deliberately arranging mass killings of whites so that they possibly, arguably, rigged up between them large numbers of deaths of, for example, Russian-educated elites, Latvians, Poles, and so on, and also entire nations in the Russian Empire. There must have been entire nation just rubbed out by Jews there, as the USSR got going. And it's possible that Hitler was a mimic all along. And the best case known to me, the best presentation, is Miles Mathis. He's got a PDF called Hiller.pdf. That's Hiller. He thinks Hiller was Hitler's real original name. So that's something to think about. It is a possibility that the whole thing was rigged up. Yeah?
Yeah, interesting.
I thought you were going to say it's depressing. It does mean that if that's true, of course, the whole business of removing Jews, prizing them out of things, appears to be more difficult than it might have seemed. Anyway, I want to just note here in passing the hostile elite idea, which apparently was Kevin McDonald's. I think McDonald is wrong, because whites have been as lethal with each other as any other groups. I'd like to hope under Jewish pressure, but I may be wrong. But of course, media censorship permits McDonald to make this mistake. He understands Jews perverting the academic world, but he remains naive about news sources. He kind of trusts them. So, but he does speak well on this grotesque Jewish behavior when he's free from these academic conventions. And it does appear to be necessary that whites develop some sort of solid, tough, firm, international, mutual, organizational opposition to Jews, who, of course, straddle the world like a sort of mycelium of a fungus, kind of, you know, with a sort of mutual support and mutual aggression against their hosts. I want to mention, here's another interesting point about the way Jews infiltrate and get into particularly aristocracies. The point here is made, for example, by Hilaire Belloc again in his book on the Jews, and Ramsay on The Nameless War is good on it too. And also Nestor Webster, I noticed the other day, of course, he was actually mentioned with approval by Churchill, rather oddly. At any rate, it's about Jews targeting aristocracies. And it's easy to miss the point that aristocrats had, you know, they had problems, they had their issues to resolve, they had difficult decisions to make, and probably were, on the whole, competent and could provide shelter. So I think probably Jewish instincts were to kind of burrow into them. It wasn't so much aggression getting a
foothold.
But I think their instincts ultimately worked against aristocracies. You have to imagine the contempt of Jews for people like Giuliani after 9/11 and McNamara, a sort of professional war criminal, and Professor Evans of, I think he's at Oxford or somewhere now. And there's that Manchester police chief, you know, shuffling through his script of lies. It's Not to mention, you know, simple white soldiers just following orders, ending up homeless. It gives you some idea of what contempt Jews have for these people, and it's understandable. Who can blame them? So I think, anyway, I think that Jews, when they're not homing in on would-be aristocrats, they went for ambitious but rather ordinary types, like Emperor Constantine. Incidentally, I've got what I think is quite a nice piece on the early church and the way it got corrupted by Jews. This is the way it seems likely, anyway. It's biglies.org/general, and then it's early-christianity-bible.html. And I've included the manufacture of Islam in that, because the manufacture of Islam seems to have been another Jewish thing, using a book, same kind of principle as Jewish writings in the Bible. Anyway, the outcome of Jews in Russia, of course, was a disaster. It devastated the country, and it must have erased a lot of nations from their land empire. And apart from the thefts and murders within the USSR, it was funded by Jews outside the country. You know, American companies, British companies, German and Italians, and they imported factories and mining plants. But even with all that, their exit strategy, the Jewish exit strategy, was to collapse it in 1991. So I think, although they appear to show self-confidence, usually it's an absolute disaster. And of course, they have their own apologetic lies amongst themselves to pretend that they're honest and so on. The general impression, a very important issue, of course, is followers, the puppets of Jews, and Freemasons are the most well-known. Most identifiable. And of course, the general impression of everybody is that the Freemasons are dishonourable and shifty, cunning liars, backstabber types, which I'm sure is true. There's no reason why it wouldn't be true. But of course, they're ambitious. In modern society, of course, you get vast numbers of rather ordinary people. And if you want to become extraordinary, you have to do that sort of thing, possibly, or at least it's an option. Let me make another note here on mimicry, which, for example, I mean, Russell was a victim of. It impressed Belloc particularly. He's got quite a good description here, although it's kind of too short, really. Belloc said in the 1920s, a Jew will pass his life in, say, three different communities in turn, and in each, the people who've met him will testify that he seemed just like themselves. And he gives an example of a Jew in Germany who moved to France, then the USA. He says his German name had been pronounced after the German fashion. In France, where German names are common, he retained it but pronounced it in the French fashion. On reaching the United States, he changed it to a Scotch name, which it distantly resembled. This is a marvelous characteristic in the Jews. It differentiates them from all the rest of mankind. Had that characteristic power of superficial mutation been absent, the 19th century policy would have broken down as completely as the Northern policy towards the Negro broke down in the United States. Note that Belloc didn't... There's lots of things that Belloc didn't understand about Jewish power. The amazing fact is that the Jew takes on with inexplicable rapidity the colour of his environment. That unique characteristic was the support of the liberal attitude in the 19th century and also its necessary condition. Now, mimicry extends a long way beyond what Belloc describes. The New York Times, for example, mimics a serious newspaper. You have huge publishing industries, mass marketing books with pseudonymous authors who are, ghostwriters who basically copy copy serious books and remove any parts they don't like. And you get publishing in cycles, for example, with carefully planned hollow hoax stories every few years, although I hope this is starting to decline now. And if you have things like magazines like Time and the National Geographic masquerade as academic books, although those again seem to be dying a death, fortunately, in my view. And you have judges in the legal system, of course, they decide whenever it's possible for Jews. You have fake websites and YouTubes as well. I noticed one, I don't know if you know the chap, I forget his name, the sort of pullover to blowhard advertising type. He did a video on Palestinians as crybabies. I think that's been removed, though. Probably too much.
Wow.
shit like him. And of course, Jewish films habitually repeat Jewish lies. I mean, there's things on Mandela or Gandhi, and of course, war films are notoriously.
And also, Ray, just sorry to jump in, but how about Parliament Square in London? We've got a statue of Mandela and Gandhi in our Parliament Square. What's that all about? Of course, near Winston Churchill as well, another hero.
It's strange, isn't it? The British Museum has a bust of Anne Frank, you know. It's also got stuff on the Shakespeare authorship thing. It's very sad that I think Jews do that as a to show their control, really. I mean, this sort of stuff should not be there in a serious academic place, but you know, they like to show here we are. Are we powerful or what? Is the slogan by David Irving, all power, or are we powerful or not? Anyway, okay, one thing is mimicry, but constructive work is something else. If you look at the USSR, it originated pretty much nothing. Apart from Jewish murder techniques, they didn't even invent things like battery chickens, which, of course, the slogan was chicken in every pot. They did absolutely nothing.
Well, I think they were too busy spinning the chickens around their heads, weren't they, Ray?
Yeah, cute custom. Yeah. So anyway, in practice, they fall back on repetition. It's usually of their own past. In fact, there's a Talmudic reason for it, I think. Well, I don't know the detail. I mean, for example, there's a recent British, quotes British, unquote, TV series based on Jack the Ripper, which, of course, is one of the things that Jews would do. They go back to their quotes, triumphs. And you get the same sort of thing with films and advertising. You know, Jews run advertising agencies. They have endless promotions of their own books, films, their own pathetic apologies for stars. And of course, a lot of people now are latching onto this. They notice the systematic use of mixed race, quotes, couples, unquote, an anti-white campaign. And they also, even possibly greater, as they're starting to learn about family damage and absurd perversions which are Jew pushed. Although the people who, it's a mixed bag, some people understand that, but they don't understand the Jewish connection, which is quite unusual. It's difficult. I spoke to a woman who was interested in teaching kids to read, and she had detected that the technique they use, the sort of look and say method, is bullshit, and I presume it was pushed by Jews. And I said to her, look, maybe this is a Jewish thing, why don't you investigate that? And I go, that's another, I've got quite enough controversy. So I don't know what's going to happen there. It remains to be seen. I'm trying to encourage people to think more, make more effort. So it's possible that the whole world will end up like the USSR, but of course it won't have external support now. There won't be a way of them tapping into USA money and productivity. So presumably you'll end up with nothing working properly, science failing, and public utilities like water and sewage will vanish or not work. There'll be thefts and crimes everywhere. Buildings will decay, and sort of Jewish rage and murders and their general screeching will go up in a kind of hopeless way. And some lucky whites will try to escape into evasions, and others will be forced to fight or starve. And I think it's possible the decline of Rome, the slow decline of Rome, maybe provides a model. H.G. Wells' mate George Gissing wrote a novel, Veranilda, which included material on the loss of lots of practical skills after Rome fell. So we might get multicultural areas fractured up into separate groups with no urge to assimilate, and with loyalty, if that, only to family or their caste. And India and Brazil are models, really, of whether no groups have much of a majority. And, of course, that's possibly the object of Jews. It's an obvious parasitic thing to do. But, of course, being instinctively parasitical, they probably will ignore the problems of skill and technique and so on until it's too late. Let me just try to get into another thing here. Another trick which is worth noting and being on guard about is the use of occasional deaths and atrocities, and which may or may not be faked. And, of course, this is part of the Jewish technique. You get, say, the Japanese attack at Pearl Harbor. They use that as a trigger for war, again, for enormously increased violence and war. And they knew, that, of course, they arranged it to happen in the first place. But this is a thing which people fall for all the time. I'll give a couple of personal examples. There's Patrick Moore, who was an astronomer of sorts, and he hated the Germans throughout the Second World War because I think his girlfriend got bombed.
Yeah, I heard that. Yeah, yeah. He never married again. He never saw anyone else. That was.
I don't know. I wouldn't. Be. And Alfred North Whitehead, he was once famous, mate of Russell's. His son was killed during the First World War, to his appalling grief, and of course that tended to make them militaristic. But you see, in both cases, they had war declared on them. They think people shouldn't fight back. So it's unrealistic to think that. Why should they not fight back? So if their sons were killed, you know, what do you expect? But anyway, false flags combined with media repetition are very effective. And 9/11, of course, is a perfect example. You know, it was run up by Jews. And again, as with NASA, it was a huge kind of industry. All of these Jews collaborated in faking this stuff and making sure it was on their digital TVs at the same time. Of course, they slightly misjudged it, I think, because at that time people were starting to get their own home equipment, and there were a lot of rather embarrassing 9/11 events which were digitally stored, and of course that remains permanent. It's not like VHS tape or something, and it's interchangeable. So 9/11, I think, will turn out to be one of the biggest sort of crumbling factors in the Jewish hegemony. And you get all sorts of things. As you get, for example, somebody that you say, you're discussing Hitler, somebody says, he got a military award, so he must have been militaristic. And, you know, it's just one piece of evidence, which may in fact not be true. And I mean, you might as well say that Obama and Kissinger got Nobel Peace Prizes, so they must be peaceful. I mean, people come up with stuff all the time. It's important to have a good overview, not just pick on one little item. And, of course, conversely, if you're Jewish, you invent one little item and promote it indefinitely. You get this thing all the time. If you remember the programs about the appalling racism of the English in just after the war, and there was a sign that said, you know, no Irish, no blacks, no dogs, or something like that.
Yeah.
And this gets repeated. No evidence for it, and what does it matter anyway? But this is the sort of thing that Jews do. It's much easier to invent something or pick a crap example than to do serious research. And however, there is a slight counter these days, because it's easier to check on lies, or it can be. You can go online and you get similar effects to Jews who are baffled when they're shown video proof. You know, instinctively they're used to a group lying, and when new techniques make this impossible, and they're completely at sea and baffled, you know, they sort of look around like startled sort of pygmies or something. So there is some evidence that checking would be more difficult. And of course, they've developed countermeasures. I mean, the 9/11, they destroyed the evidence about, I think it was two sets of frauds, wasn't it? There was one in the Pentagon, some investigation on some Jewish fraud, and there was Building 7, I think it was.
Yeah, I think the Enron investigation was in Building 7.
Oh, Enron. Yeah, that's right. What, do you remember the one in the Pentagon?
All I can think is it's the 2.3 trillion, was it, that had gone missing that they'd announced the day before.
Yeah,
that Rumsfeld announced the day before, yep.
Yeah, that's right. That's another typical Jewish thing, isn't it?
Yeah, we've got, just to let you know, because I know that you prepared your notes for the show, we've got just under 20 minutes left, Ray, so hopefully you'll get through everything.
I've got a set of reviews on my website, big-lies.org/reviews, another slash probably. It's a big file. I decided as a policy to put all my reviews together in a sort of whopping great file, which has now got too big, really. And I would ask and encourage people to look at these, because I've tried to make them fully revisionist reviews, and it's a bit of a morass. It's hard to find your way through because there's just so much of it. But if you click, you can find indexes and find book titles. There's one here. There's one I'm quite proud of. It's a review of Spy Catcher by Peter Wright. You may remember that from years ago. I specifically looked at the Jewish element there, and Wright is rather pathetically, really. He never had any idea of that in his lifetime. It was quite funny to see how he had the wool pulled over his eyes. And Hollis, the alleged bloke behind, I think it was MI5 or MI6, interviewed Peter Wright, and he was just amused that Peter Wright was so utterly clueless. I've got a review here of Lane on The Alien Menace. I recommend that book because it's journalistic, it's not kind of academic. It has good material on, for example, Jews continually invading Britain from the 19th century and changing their names. Very good. A lot of people don't understand. They say, for example, somebody like Livingstone or George Galloway or something, you know, their dad was called Murray or something, so they couldn't possibly be Jews. They don't realise that there's a multi-generation thing. Once they get in and they're recorded as British by the inefficient system there, then, of course, it's perfectly possible they are Jews. I suspect, I mean, Galloway, for example, has got the absolute sort of image of it. He believes the Holocaust. He's got no intention of investigating that, and he never mentions the Jews who run Arab countries. So anyway, so that's Lane is quite a good chap. I've got a good review of Hobsbawm, who of course was a Jewish phony historian. His book, The Age of Extremes. I've done. It's quite well. There's a lot in there. I mean, I happen to know a lot of the stuff that he just quotes. He's not even a serious historian in a science sense. He records a lot of scientific junk. In fact, a lot of the stuff which is wrong. Because, of course, he knows that he's not interested. He doesn't know any better. There's another one here, is an obituary I did of Dennis Healey. It's quite interesting. He was a, quotes, Labour, unquote, party.
Apparently Dennis Healey showed Margaret Thatcher around her first Bilderberg meeting. That Secret Rulers of the World film? That was one of the first things that... Sorry, Secret Rulers of the World, it was that Channel 4 series. And there was a bit where John Ronson, who's Jewish, he went on to do the film The Men Who Stare at Goats, folks. So you're probably more aware of that than a obscure Channel 4 series in the late 90s. But John Ronson asked him, because, of course, Dennis Healey was a keen photographer, if he could see any... photos that he'd taken at Bilderberg, and Healy just goes, no, fuck off.
Oh, does he? Yeah, Ronson did one on the moon landings, actually. In fact, there's a video of him. I copied it onto my website in 1999. So I've got mixed feelings about Ronson. Of course, he naturally doesn't sort of look into the nukes or the hollow hoax. Anyway, it's just a byproduct. I mean, he's generally did classics. It's an interesting example of a phenomenon that Lane in The Alien Menace maintained that the educational system was deliberately designed to keep out people with any knowledge of French or Russian or German, so they couldn't tell what was going on the continent. And of course, Healy was a classicist. He knew about Latin and Greek, but not about anything modern. Anyway, another one of my reviews that I'm quite proud of is a very long one on a book called GCHQ. It's by a non-entity called Richard Aldridge, and I went through that quite carefully to take it. In fact, he didn't even know that the USSR started in 1917. Anyway, let's look that up, Aldridge, GCHQ. There's another interesting book dating from the 60s. This is where the Jewish promotion of immigration was getting underway. It's a red-covered, thick, hefty paperback by KJB Rose, R-O-S-E, Associates. It's called British Race Relations. I've got a couple of copies of it, actually, and with stuff about Jewish promoting. There was a minority report saying that it was, presumably it's protesting against it, but the whole thing is just Jewish, including, you know, you get anecdotes, the sort of horror stories about, you know, Amos something or other was insulted on such and such a date. Absolute piffling trivia. But it's worth knowing about these things. There's another one here. H.J. Eysenck had a sort of set to with a sort of third-rate academic called Kamin, K-A-M-I-N, on intelligence mostly, and that's, I did a review of that. It was quite an interesting little book. And Kamin, of course, was promoted, but this is typically what happens with the American education system. If you get somebody who says something about Jews, they get made professors. It's absolutely extraordinary. Yeah, the most incredible rubbish you get there. I mean, that Ignatieff, it's not a serious academic. He shouldn't be there. And the whole of Yale and Harvard is
All white people must be killed, you know, this Ignatieff, and he's just still there practicing. If any white professor said that about blacks or Jews, he'd not just lose his job, but he'd be prosecuted.
Yeah, yeah. There's another book. Well, I reviewed J.P. Rushton's Race, Evolution, and Behavior. I haven't seen the... There's a cheap one. He ended up selling in large numbers cheaply, but I haven't read his full one. There's a much longer involved one, which I haven't read, but he's quite good. It seems it's absurd. I mean, the stuff he writes is, in the 19th century, would have been regarded as barely worth, you know, mentioning, but such is the situation now. Now, here's another one. It's somebody called L. Dominelli. It's called Anti-Racist Social Work, sorry. And this fascinating thing that in order to control, you know, social workers, they had to be sort of corralled, and this was part of the process was you could only get a social work diploma if you signed things or accepted that only whites can be racist, you know, that kind of stuff. It's worth, I did quite a good, I think, quite a good critique of that. There's another one here. So I reviewed some of Kevin MacDonald's books. I quite like The Culture of Critique, although it does have limitations. If you read my review, you know, see what you think.
I like the later chapter. I like the later chapter in it because I've had him on the show, and the one where he goes through all the attempts to change the immigration policy of the USA, because of course I was aware of the Hart-Celler Act, but he goes back historically showing all their involvement in the 20s and I think even before that, and that was really, really interesting. But of course, being a psychologist, most of his book concentrates on psychology, and it's worth having, but of course it is a heavy read.
I mean elegancy of writing is something that's quite difficult, and well, it's part of the American tradition to have crap writing, isn't it? Because it means the stuff is more impenetrable. Anyway, that's the way it goes. I read Karen Armstrong's book on Islam. I get quite all these things sort of secondhand, you know, books. They still have secondhand bookshops. I don't know if they'll exist much longer after Amazon. But her book on Islam is extraordinary. What rubbish! I mean, women, female writers have distinctive, their own sort of outlooks, don't they? They're incapable of being kind of acid or accurate. I've got two other interesting books here. There's one called The Protester's Handbook. It's published by The Guardian by the name credited is B.B. van der Zee, or Zee, B.B. van der Zee, Z-double-E. And I went through that. It's quite a good review. Another similar kind of naive one is a book called On CND, Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, by Kate Hudson. And of course, she hasn't a clue of the propaganda. So it's quite, in a way, it's quite pathetic and funny. But, you know, she's some sort of academic. She's got some kind of department, completely phony department of that won't look at anything serious. There's another one about Islam here by two people, Cox and Marx. Obviously, one of them. What Baroness Cox, I don't know what her background is. And there's a Jew, of course, on whether ideological Islam is compatible with democracy. I mean, it obviously isn't. And, of course, they avoid all the serious issues. Worth reading. I do quite like my reviews. The reason I write them, actually, is as much for myself as for anybody else, is to remind me what was in these things. There's another one here by Conway, The Demographic History of Britain. You know, because... You know, these typical Jewish lies to say that Britain's is a nation of immigrants and always had immigration. And Conway's makes this sort of determined effort to show this is all nonsense. It's good for him, let him try it. There's a chap here called Miles Harris, spoke with a Y, M-Y-L-E-S Harris, talking about UK asylum policy. And of course, this is all determined by Jewish lawyers and... I mean, it's nonsense. Their object, what they want to do is get as many incompatible foreigners in as possible, preferably criminals, preferably, people who will be charged on the state. Because at the moment, of course, Jews make money out of it. If you print money and the government borrows to build, you know, to fund invaders who are parasitizing off you at great lengths, obviously it needs a lot of money. So, and they charge them a percentage for it. So while it lasts, they make a lot of money out of this stuff The question is, if it's, how does it... In fact, I think the sustainability might be one of the reasons for their sudden Jewish push for, in the US for, you know, those anti-Trump stuff and so on, and more immigration in Europe, more, you know, whole boats being deliberately chartered and so on to cross the Mediterranean, that sort of thing. Deliberate policy to flood Britain. And I think it may be that you see, we're in a position where we have a Treasury Department. They're obviously staffed with dishonest people. Every single fucking one of them, they're all liars. And it's the same with the EU. They must have Treasury people there who keep everything secret. But I suspect, although I may be wrong, that there are sort of red lights flashing. There's stuff is starting to run out here and there. And so Jews, rather than do something useful about it, are sort of piling on the pressure. That's my best guess, but who knows?
There's something why they're ramping it up so quickly, isn't there, Ray? I mean, they've always got away with stuff because they've done it by gradualism, but now it's almost like they're in a race against time. What do you?
That's right, yeah. I think it may be to do with what they're concerned with most, because of the money of it, because they may be coming up against limits to loans, limits to the amount they can pirate off people. And of course people are getting, I mean, if this hollow hoax thing, if that gets popular, people are going to want their money back. You know, why should they have forked out for a bunch of crooks? So there are things hanging over these people, and I hope it comes to some sort of victory. I think we have to work at it. There's a book about somebody called Grayling, I think he's one of these lightweight professors, The Struggle for Liberty and Rights, and of course that's pure Jewish, you know, bullshit. I wrote quite a nice review on that. I've got a book here, Oh, Hanged by the Neck. This is one of my bookshop purchases. It was a Penguin book. Penguin, of course, are notorious for propaganda. And this is a red-backed one. It's supposed to be about current issues, you know, flagged down, Hanged by the Neck. It was part of the capital punishment thing. This, of course, was after the... vast numbers, after leading Germans had been hanged, there had been mass murders in Eastern Europe, but here they are pretending to be, you know, humanitarian. I did quite a good review on Noam Chomsky's book, The Spectacular Achievements of Propaganda, pointing out that some of the most spectacular achievements, like the suppression of truth about the USSR and Jewish money power and so on, are not meant to, that's a spectacular achievement of propaganda, but of course Chomsky doesn't mention that. Anyway, I've got a lot of things like that. I do encourage people to have a look, or look at somebody else's if you want, but at least have a look. It's part of the psychology of human learning, in my view, that repetition, if you repeat things, they stick better and they get learnt better, whether they're true or not. I think that's quite important. That you can see why evolutionarily that's a good thing, on the whole, because if you fail to learn after many repetitions, then you could well have a problem. And I would recommend people who are doing this kind of stuff to talk between themselves, find other people who are of a similar mind, or might be of a similar mind, or at least are intelligent, have to discuss this stuff with them and make it fix it in your head, so that you've got some of this stuff at your fingertips. Don't just kind of skim over it and not do much about it. Anyway, I've got another thing. I've got some reviews of films. I've got a speculation here on the Rillington Place murder, which of course has occurred several times in Jewish films. And I think that was an interesting example of where prostitutes were murdered. I'd presume that they were controlled by Jews. This is the usual pattern. And I think the chap who was finally hanged had been told that he'd get a free pardon after the capital punishment had been abolished. He expected to get a free pardon and be taken care of for the rest of his life. It's worth having a look at that kind of stuff. I better get through here a bit quicker. If you want to look up Jewish propaganda, here's another one of my website addresses. It's biglies.org/Jewish-propaganda-UK. That should be capitalized, probably. /Jewish-propaganda-books.html. Sorry, that's rather long. It looks right through from 1908 to 1948. It includes the Jewish Left Book Club by Victor Gerlanx, who's often with exquisite irony, is often portrayed or portrays himself as a philanthropist. And it's interesting, you can see, for example, Penguin Books deliberately printed the names of their printers so that, you know, one of the ways Jews get at people like printers is deny them their work. You know, if they won't publish their stuff, they suddenly find they're not going to be printing anything. That's what happened to David Irving. There are other ones. There's Dimbleby and Attenborough, two examples. I mean, I didn't realize Attenborough was, when he was younger, was a part of the BBC censorship process. This was, I think, this was during, or maybe
he
just
was,
after the time that
he was he was director general, David Attenborough. I'm like, you know, in the 50s or something. Yeah, it was weird.
I was reading his. I think he's a Jew. He must be. I think because just from the general fingerprint. But so he was one of these people. You know, people. Oh, isn't he a wonderful chap? You know, and he was just a plagiarist. He did no original work in natural history. And while of course there was a Jewish military person in charge of the BBC just after 1945 to make sure they kept quiet about all the atrocities. And Attenborough was one of them. These people are utter garbage. This is what makes me think it's instinctive. I mean, Dimbleby is another Jew, both Dimbleby's. And of course, I just think it must be instinctive. He spent his whole life just telling lies on behalf of Jews. It must be. I can't believe it's not a genetic thing. Anyway, that's depressing stuff, isn't it? And oh, by the way, remember that Rupert Murdoch was part of all this entire lie machinery. You have to think of the lies that these people come up with. That's absolutely kind of shocking, really. I was going to look at a few other books here. There's a paperback on the property boom by Oliver Marriott. This was about in the 60s. And of course, at that point, paper money was funding the thing. And if you could get your hands on paper money, then of course you could buy real property and then it would go up because they'd inflate it. Although they wouldn't word it like that, so you get all these books, you know, saying nothing about the serious issues there. We have a 1978 book on mugging, which he calls the socially constructed phenomenon. This idea, all these phrases start coming out. If you're interested in books from the past, however kind of repulsive they are, it's often worth looking through them just to sort of get the feel of them. An example is a Jewish yearbook. I've got one here, a centenary edition, 1996. Absolutely packed with innumerable little groups, little organisations in every country, every county, every town in Britain, all kinds of things. And of course, there's a list of prominent Jews, but these are only the ones who choose to be listed. There's vast numbers, of course, who are crypto Jews, are Jews, but they don't tell anybody. Here's another book. Here we are: Education and the Labour Movement, 1870 to 1920. Published by Lawrence and Wishart, who, of course, are Jewish publishers. And you get this, the whole labor movement, of course, was corralled by Jews because they had the money to do it. And that's an interesting book. I mean, it masquerades as a serious book. You know, it's printed in a sort of boring typeface with a boring cover design. It's deliberate. It's meant to impress people that it's a serious book. I've got another book here I've just found, with C.V. Veronica Wedgwood, The King's War, 1958. She was a professor at either Oxford or Cambridge. That hardly matters. And of course, there's no mention of money in there in the Civil War in Britain. Of course, there's the thing about war, of course, you can have endless details, all kinds of little incidents and big incidents and descriptions and stuff. But the underlying movements, the underlying plans and coercions are not mentioned. It's to put forward the idea that wars are kind of spontaneous and it's a bit like revolutions. The idea is to pretend that they're put out by people in a sort of a spontaneous, natural development.
I think the best thing I read on the British Civil War was Captain Archibald Moore Ramsay, who you referenced earlier in his book, The Nameless War. It's a short book and he does a short chapter on all these different things. It's very interesting. We're pretty much out of time, but if there's just a couple of things you want to throw in, we can overrun, Ray.
No, it's okay. Let's keep it at that time. I don't want to damage your timing thing. Can I just make a final statement?
Yeah, go ahead.
I just would appeal to people to just make an effort, you know. Even if you've never heard this stuff before, just get into it and kind of remember bits and pieces of it. I remember Alfred Whitehead had a policy of when he found some new historical thing which he thought was important, he'd kind of make notes and he'd fix it in his mind. And without going that far, it's important to be sort of armed. You have to have intellectual self-defense, really. So if you find a good counter to some argument, try and fix it in your head. Don't let it skid and slide away, because it may be that this stuff is going to become very important in the future, and we really don't want, or at least I don't really don't want to go through more very destructive wars, really, of anybody really, but particularly at the present time of whites, because whites are being targeted. And I think I'll leave it there.
Thank you, Ray. And also, bear in mind what Ray said about he did these reviews primarily because he wanted to make his notes as to what he got out of the book. And that's very important. That's how I did my books, because I always say to people that it just started off as a timeline, because there are so many people saying, you know, this group killed Kennedy, that group killed Kennedy. I didn't want to spend the rest of my life listening to different people apportioning blame to different people as to who killed Kennedy. So I listened to it a lot. I looked into all the different angles that I saw, and then I came up with what I thought was the correct and most likely solution. And then I moved on. And that's the way that you can do things. Otherwise, you keep looking at the same thing. What's your thoughts on that, Ray?
Oh, I think that's absolutely right. It's best to do things like that. And also, if possible, if you can find people to communicate with, you can learn a lot from other people. Just one name might be important. So give it a go. But I suppose I have to warn people to be cautious. You can't necessarily, you have to be a bit careful. Things might get really, really unpleasant. And so to some extent, keep your own counsel. Anyway, it's very nice of you to invite me back, and I'm glad to hear I'm popular, if I am.
You certainly are. And one thing before you go, I just want to thank the blog sites out there. I'm talking Zap at Mammy's Shit, Hooli at Hooli's Blog, and Dion, who's been on the show from Radio Werewolf with his Heartland Online, because they put shows like this out and others. And they really help spread the word, and they don't have to do these things. They're not paid to advertise it or anything. They just do it off their own back, and that's another way people can help. And I thank them for promoting the show. And I noticed when Hooli's Blog put out our last show, Ray, they also included a link to our first show, and I've never seen them do that before. So I believe it looks like they considered it those two shows very good, and I hope that they like this one as well.
Can I just add also that YouTube and Google are clamping down a bit. They have a sort of partial censorship where, for example, my talk on salt in food, it's not exactly censored, but it doesn't come up on my list of videos. So if there are people out there, by all means, put links into anything you like, really. Any link might be helpful. It might add a bit of, it might change somebody's life, you know. They might find something. So links and publicity, yeah, fine. I'm all in favour of it. And, you know, keep your powder dry. And if you're this kind of temperament, you might find it worthwhile collecting books and magazines and newspaper clippings, something like that, I don't know, or stuff from online. Because if you keep them somewhere, if you sort of tuck them away somewhere, they're there, and you can fan them into fan the embers back into the reality. Otherwise, you end up with just a vague feeling, but not the sort of guts of it. Anyway, I'd like to thank you very much for inviting me on again, and thanks. I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, likewise, Ray. And just before we go, folks, I'm just going to... what Ray just said reminded me that I looked at my YouTube page yesterday, and I've only got the 8 videos from the Synagogue of Satan, and I noticed the first one that had got over 100,000 views is missing. I haven't had any note from YouTube. They've taken it down, but they've taken it down. They haven't told me or anything. And the next one, I think, has got only... the next most visited is only about 6,200 views or something, it tells me. I don't really trust those figures, but it's funny that, isn't it?
Well, we have to hope that maybe these outfits will become get superseded, although I'm not entirely happy about government ones being as good. But I don't think they're quite as technically advanced as they used to be. And I can see that there might come a time when there are good rivals. Maybe even a Russian one. Maybe there might be a Russian site that everybody goes to. I don't know. But anyway, at least they're still there for the moment. So anyway, thanks.
Sorry, Ray. Every time you say something, you make me think of something else. So we'll definitely wrap it up now. Thank you so much for being on, my friend. It was a great show. I want to thank everybody for listening. I'll be back with you all soon. And bye for now.
You have been listening to the Andrew Carrington Hitchcock Show on TBR Radio, brought to you by the Barnes Review. Andrew's book, The Synagogue of Satan, is now available on his website, andrewcarringtonhitchcock.com, in an updated, expanded, and uncensored edition.